Okay, wash your mouth.
Thank God you saved me from the streets of Dawn.
That's right. Get Bill. You have a quorum.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to call the Committee on Community Services to order. Today is August 9th, and we have a quorum, and having Legislator Myers and Legislator Burton and myself present.
We're now called to order the meeting of the Legislation Committee, and we have legislators Williams, Burton, Rogowski, Harkham, Burroughs, and Myers all present. And it's 2 p.m. We want to apologize to everyone here for our late start, but due to the breakdown of our system this morning, we weren't able to start our Board of Legislators meeting until 11:30. It was supposed to start at 10. We couldn't record the meeting, which is required by law, so we really backed up. We caught up to a certain extent. We're not an hour and a half behind anymore. We're about a half an hour behind. So the purpose of today's meeting is to begin consideration of proposed legislation which would make it an offense to commit the crime or offense of cyberbullying as defined in the proposed law. And we have a number of speakers today. I want to thank everyone for coming. I'm not sure. Let me find out who's here. We're going to start with the bill sponsors just telling us about the bill and why they're introducing it. And I believe the only sponsor here is Judy Myers at this point.
No, I think Alfred is on
the list. You're on it too? Okay, yes. So either one of you
Harkham's
or both of you.
Harkham's on the list.
Yes.
Then we're going to hear from the County Attorney's Office. Who's here from Marty Gleason? Thank you. Professor Waldman, are you here?
Hi.
Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate your taking the time to come, and again, apologize for being late. And then Perry Aftab is going to be on the phone. Lisa Davis from the Westchester Putnam School Board, thank you for coming. Isabel Burke, the Coordinator of School Safety for Southern Westchester Bochies, is here. And Assistant District Attorney Mary Corner.
And Michael
Lurie. Right. Michael Lurie is here, too. Right. That's right. Okay, so let's start. That's a pretty ambitious program we have for today. Hopefully we can get through it. And then the next meeting we can, the legislators can give comments and ask questions. So we can hopefully we have time for questions for the speakers today, but we can begin our committee discussion at the next meeting.
And I just note the presence of Legislator Preston of the Community Services Committee.
Okay, so legislators William and Myers, do you want to start us off as bill as two of the sponsors? If any other sponsor wants to speak?
I will start. I think this is something that we have seen rather new phenomenon, but really just a different play on the act of bullying itself, which we have seen in this county and in this state and in this nation increase. So I think what my interest is right now is listening to some of the experts in terms of just the basically the legitimacy of this kind of legislation and whether we could move forward with it.
Anybody else? Any other sponsor want to add anything? Legislator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The act of bullying is very often considered basically childish pranking, and it is, in fact, more than that. Depending on who the victim is and what the methodology that it comes into play, it can be physical, it is intended to be hurtful, and it very often results in unexpected behavior by the person being bullied to the point where there have been incidences of suicide, there have been incidences of mental breakdown, there have been instances of property damage, and it is more than cranking. The question is, and I think we have very much got the opportunity to hear from people who are in the field, is whether or not this practice can be regulated through law, or whether it is something that only the participants and the people right at the very exercise of this are the only ones who will be able to control it. I don't know the answer, and that's why I joined the legislative Myers in wanting to hear from the experts on this. But I do wish that we would get away from the idea that this is just a nanny state response to a non-issue that befalls only certain people. It's not. It's far more serious than that. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. We've been joined by legislators Burton and Abinanti, and the sponsors are just making a statement, and anybody else before we get into the discussion.
Ryan.
Let's say it's Ryan.
I'll
now.
Be Ryan today.
Who did I say?
You get the other bill.
Oh. Let's say Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, thank you. I'll be very brief. Agree with everything that Legislator Burton has said about the seriousness of this issue, and with a middle school child and a high school child, and to hear the stories they tell about their peers and what is going on in the schools and the intimidation that occurs through texting, through email, through web pages, through Facebook. It gets the hair up on your neck, and I think Legislator Burton was very eloquent in summarizing, you know, what this does to kids. So I hope that we can make a difference on this. You, Mr. Chair, have raised some legitimate questions about the jurisdiction of the county board in this issue, and we'll look into that with an open mind. But I look forward to hearing testimony from our experts today. So thank you.
Ms. Aptat, thanks for joining us. We are beginning our meeting, and we have a series of speakers. You're on the list, and we thank you for joining us.
I just want to echo the comments that have been made by the other sponsors in that the increasing seriousness of this act has affected many, many households in my own constituent area. I'm aware of one incident where the whole family was traumatized by cyberbullying. So I too want to hear the experts and find if and what we can do to eliminate or minimize these incidents.
And before we start, let me just say that I commend my fellow legislators for, you know, raising this issue and bringing it before this board for consideration. And as Legislator Harkins, and I agree with the comments made by Legislator Burton about what's the best way to deal with this issue. And as Legislator Harkins said, I have raised some issues. And I would like everyone to keep in mind this question. While it may make us feel good to pass this legislation, will this legislation actually do any good? Is this an appropriate subject for the county to deal with? Can we enforce it? Can we enforce it effectively? Are there existing laws which can and should and maybe are being used to deal with this problem? And finally, and I'm glad we have a constitutional law scholar here, I'm concerned about part of this law with respect to, I'm concerned with the First Amendment implications of part of this law. The county attorney has addressed some of those issues. And I'm concerned about the First Amendment issues, not only on the face of the law, but how it might be applied and whether it's overbroad. And those are issues, the First Amendment issues, that I think we have to take very seriously. I know cyberbullying is a serious problem, but once you start incurring or intruding on areas that might be affected by a First Amendment, you're going down a very slippery slope. And the First Amendment is the First Amendment with a small f for a reason. So I just want to skip some of my comments, but again, I'm keeping an open mind as well. Legislator Abinanti?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did not have the benefit of the comments of my colleagues. I'll be very brief and attempt not to repeat them. I recognize the need for our reviewing this issue. It seems to me that bullying, no matter what method is used, whether it be on the street, a telephone, or the electronic means, is wrong and should be regulated. I have concerns like you do, one about how you draft it to make sure that it's protected, it doesn't infringe on First Amendment rights. But I think we've dealt with that in other areas as well. I mean, you know, the words that are used on the street are not going to be very different than what you're using by electronic media. So I think there's enough case law there so we can be guided. I am a little concerned, if not by the legal issues, but also the question of whether we should try to regulate conduct that might happen in California. And that's what troubles me, because you're dealing here with, you may have a victim in Westchester County, but now we're putting the county into a situation of having to work its way through this whole system, you know, and it's a very difficult area. It just, I would like to see the federal government deal with the issue so that we didn't have to, or the state at least deal with the issue so that we didn't have to. I have an open mind. I'm willing to consider the legislation, but I'm troubled about whether it's a good idea to get the Westchester County Police involved in something that's happening in California. I'm a little bit more comfortable with regulating conduct within our county. So if there's somebody sitting in an office here misusing a computer here, then I'm a little bit more comfortable with regulating that conduct. But trying to tell somebody in Iowa that, hey, you've misused the computer or the internet, and you violated our laws, I would feel very uncomfortable with Iowa passing a law telling people in Westchester County that they can't do something. And you get into this whole question of different standards of what's acceptable and what's acceptable conduct. How far can you go? There are certain mores and certain acceptable conduct that we kind of share by living in Westchester County. But when you go to different parts of the country, things are interpreted differently. And I'm just concerned about our trying to impose our standards on people elsewhere, and I would be very upset to see people elsewhere try to impose those standards on people acting in our county. You know, it's like they say, when you're in Rome, do as the Romans do, but at least you've chosen to go there. But, you know, and can learn from the people around you when you're there. But doing it you do an email and you hit a reply all, and it ends up in somebody's box in Italy, I think we would be very, or in Sweden or somewhere, we would be very upset if the international police started to police their mores over there, Iran or Iraq, saying, hey, you guys in the United States are violating our laws, and we're going to send somebody out to bring you in because you said something which violates our...
We got your point. We go to the speakers?
Yes, thank you.
No, good that's point. Yeah. And Marty Gleason from the county attorney's office will ask you to come up first. And the county attorney's office was drafted the legislation, was asked to look at several issues, made some changes to the original legislation, did a memo regarding constitutional issues and the issue of jurisdiction to prosecute violators who may be in another state, where the victim may be in Westchester,
right,
which is similar to the issue raised by legislator Abinanti, although I think, Tom, you raised a broader issue.
Yeah, broader issue, right.
So, Marty, would you just tell us just summarize for us what work the county attorney's office has done and the opinion you've come to, the memorandum that you've come to.
Okay.
To give it to us.
County attorney drafted an opinion dated July 30th, 2010. And we were asked to look at two issues, specifically the constitutionality.
Hold on a second. Ms. Aptak, can you hear us? Just want to make sure you're on the line.
I can. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
You can call me Perry.
Okay, Perry. Okay.
County attorney was asked to look at the constitutionality of the statute, or I should say of the legislation as drafted, and also jurisdictional issues as to whether or not an individual who commits cyberbullying under this proposed statute in a state other than New York could be prosecuted in New York State for the offense. As to the constitutional issues, the county attorney looked at the different prescriptions in the draft legislation and determined that at least three of the four prescriptions that are in the draft legislation could probably survive what's called a facial challenge, constitutional challenge, that is, as applied in general. Those prescriptions could survive because they are related to things like threats, true threats, threats of violence, threats of physical property damage, and causing extreme emotional disturbance. As to the fourth prescription that was in the original draft, that dealt with basically disrupting the school environment or creating what's referred to as a hostile education environment. And it was based on a number of cases and a number of statutes that have been drafted. The county attorney reviewed that and determined that there isn't a great deal of case law out there to support the conclusion that a criminal statute, and then this statute that's before you today is a criminal statute, there isn't a lot of case law out there to support the conclusion that a criminal statute could be drafted that would survive a constitutional challenge based on hostile educational environment. So for that reason, the county attorney recommends you reconsider the legislation without that particular prescription. But the other three that I mentioned would remain in the legislation. That was a facial challenge.
I just want to mention for people, the members of the committees who were here and the public who's here, the three items that are still in there make it an offense to, quote, place such other person in actual or reasonable fear of physical harm to himself or herself or to a third person, or B, placing such other person in actual or reasonable fear of property damage, or C, and this is the one I think I have an issue with or concern about, quote, a substantial detrimental effect on such other person's physical or emotional health, unquote. So those are the three you're talking about.
Those are the three I'm talking about.
Go ahead. Sorry. Just want to make sure everybody's clear.
So those three, likely the county attorney opined, would likely survive a facial challenge. What the county attorney was concerned about and remains concerned about is an as-applied challenge. As applied means under any given set of circumstances, the statute as applied could be held unconstitutional. As you know, we're dealing with the First Amendment very clearly. You have to be very, very careful that the kind of activity that's or expressive conduct that's prescribed is not First Amendment protected. It would not be a criminal act for a student, for example, to post their website merely criticizing another student. Or perhaps, calling that student certain names, so to speak. That, you have to be very careful because the First Amendment would protect that type of speech. And under any given set of circumstances, if someone was to be subject to prosecution based on something that did not go to the extreme that this statute at least tries to articulate, okay, then they could that particular prosecution could be subject to an as-applied constitutional challenge. So I think that's one thing I think the county attorney was concerned about in terms of the constitutional implications of this proposed legislation. If there are any questions on constitutional aspects of the opinion.
I just think it's fair to note. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, if you could just get into that a little deeper. You're talking about comments made about somebody, but that would not be the intent of this law anyhow. So what we're really talking about is if someone made bodily threats or try to incite other people to make bodily harm against somebody, I guess that you're saying would not be unconstitutional, but just saying, someone, eats gopher guts for breakfast, that type of thing is protected by free speech.
Exactly. Fighting words.
Yeah, I mean, the threat, I think we're more comfortable with the threat one, but for the third one, substantial detrimental effect, one teenager could send a young woman an email that says, you're a bitch, you're a whore. Now, that could affect someone emotionally getting that email very much, but I would suspect most people would agree that's protected by the First Amendment. Right. As nasty as it is, the First Amendment doesn't protect language that's nice. It protects some pretty mean language.
Well, we
nasty language. So that's the issue where can you prohibit that, which isn't a threat,
right,
but can certainly have a detrimental emotional,
and
can affect somebody emotionally. Some young girl gets that email, she could be very bothered by it. Anyway,
what we tried to do, at least when we crafted this statute, bearing in mind that we were concerned about as-applied challenges, we crafted language that said that the conduct has to be severe, persistent, or pervasive. Okay, that doesn't necessarily state it, but that was what we're getting at. It has to be very severe. It can't be, as we've said, just a comment about, a criticism or, something that rises to the level of name-calling. Obviously, it's protected. The Constitution protects, incivility towards one another. And any statute that tries to make conduct that merely is expressive, in a sense, is not going to survive a constitutional challenge. I think it's very clear. But as to the Chairman noticed a comment about your last one dealing with the emotional detrimental effect on a person's emotional health. We're trying to get at to survive facial challenges, that language about severe, persistent, or pervasive, in other words, that it doesn't end. It's going on, it rises to a level that obviously, other than it's ordinary, and we'll quote what you say, but
think because of that pervasive, if someone sent the email that I mentioned every day for a month, that would take it out of the First Amendment protection?
Well, no.
I'm not sure of that.
I'm not sure. Can I answer by saying I'm not sure?
I mean,
but if someone ridicules someone to a point of, rises to a level of that person can't show his face in school, perhaps.
Going beyond the direct communication to them.
Post a website with the compromising photograph.
Right.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, for example, maybe. Right.
Interesting issues here,
Mr. Chairman. A few years ago, our awareness was taken to a new level on cyberbullying when the legislature and the county executive met with people over at the county center on a program one day that really laid in front of us examples of the types of things that were going on where. Mostly teenagers are using new technology to do these things to other kids. But it's interesting. A persistent email between two people goes to one level. An email or a posting to a website sharing that same information goes to something else. There was a case that a number of us saw a few years ago where an individual photoshopped pictures and shared them. Now, before the new technology, if you photoshopped pictures of a schoolmate and somehow stapled them to telephone poles in your community, and every time you thought someone wasn't looking, you put these pictures up, and the next week, and the next week, and you kept doing this, where the general public had an opportunity to see this. And perhaps you even provided some information. Guess who this is, and this is what I'm telling you this person is, or this is what she does. Well, okay, you're not using technology. Now, today, you're able to put those same posts up so the entire universe could conceivably see this stuff. And it could, in fact, be persistent. But I think one of the questions that I have, because I know it's a delicate balance between First Amendment rights and the like. But the thing is, a lot of what you can say out there that isn't very nice and doesn't sound great, and really parents need to take them by the neck and explain to them that they're not supposed to say these things about their schoolmates or the kids in the community. But some of this stuff, under certain circumstances, goes well beyond that. And I think today the cases that we have seen that the media has covered, most of them are examples where it wasn't just something that ruffled somebody's feathers. It went so far beyond it that it actually affected the individual who was the target. In some cases, driving them. I think the case I was thinking of, the girl was driven to suicide. We have heard in the past where there is this concern for an individual's First Amendment rights, but most of the things that we get offended by in society today that involve cyberbullying go so far beyond that that it really raises the question that if we're waiting for other jurisdictions across the country kind of to follow suit. Maybe there isn't, there isn't a lot of reciprocity we can rely upon. Maybe they're still kind of entertaining the issue, trying to figure out what to do. It may very well be that some action here is necessary for us to handle cases that involve parties that are attached to Westchester County, And also, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that the county would be in a lead position on the cutting edge of stuff where other, some other jurisdictions have done it, but by and large, most places haven't gotten there yet.
This is Carrie Ackab. If it's a good time, I'd like to make a contribution and lay out what everybody else is doing around the country.
And actually, we'd like to keep the order. We have an order, if you don't mind, Perry. You're coming up. Don't worry. We got you on the list. But we'd just like to try to keep the order and deal with the county attorney's opinion. Yeah, so we've got Mr. Rogowski and then Mr. Tessa.
If I could just make sure we're focused, keep the focus here, because first of all, as I read the, and I'm looking forward to hearing from all the comments, but as we try to follow this, cyberbullying is simply, it's harassment and bullying by this means. The range of focus here, the definition is what's harassment or bullying. I mean, I think we need to keep a focus on what the issue is. It's at least under this law. So I was just curious, an hour later, is harassment or bullying? Where is that in current law, county, state?
Okay, so because
that seems like a major. The only change is cyberbullying is harassment bullying by certain mechanisms, but we really need to focus on what the issue is.
And we're going to get to that.
Okay, so that's when.
And then basically, what I was
yeah, because I'm trying to follow the discussion here. You can get sidetracked by cyber is a fancy title, but it's really the harassing and the bullying that we need to focus on. That's
as a high school teacher, I can tell you, I see it on a daily basis. Physical, face-to-face harassment, bullying, threats. This just happens to be a different method of doing the same thing.
Right. So.
Is there present laws that can cover this?
Okay. We're going to cover that. And actually, you know, the difference with this is it is only words. It's only words.
Well, it could be pictures, too.
Or pictures.
But I would think
for our legislation specifically, it is harassment and bullying with the cyber in front of it.
I would think we can only enforce anything that originates within Westchester County, not from here.
Mr. Green will address that too.
Has to originate here.
The question is what we can legally do versus what we can realistically do. So, good. You want to address that, Maureen?
You want to talk about the jurisdiction?
I think we can. The only thing I've noticed on the cases you cited is that all except one were actually civil cases, not criminal cases, where someone sued for extreme emotional distress as a tort.
There was a stalking case.
And in one case, the criminal case, was where someone actually followed the person around.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead.
Jurisdictional issues. The current procedure law.
It's page 6 of the memo, by the way.
It starts at page 6. And the question was whether or not if someone engage in quote-unquote cyberbullying as defined in statute, and they did that from out of state, whether or not the prosecution could take place in Westchester. And what the county attorney has written is that basically there's a couple of statutes that come into play, both of which are in the criminal procedure law. The first statute says that New York State has jurisdiction to prosecute an offense if an element of that offense occurred within the state. And what the county attorney opined is that the statute is drafted, the cyberbullying statute, deals with an individual who communicates. And communicating usually has two parts, a sender and a receiver. So if that communication takes place, is in fact received in New York State, the argument being then New York State would have jurisdiction. If someone, say, in California was to post a website which could be viewed and was in fact received in Westchester County, then that would be all that New York State and the county itself would need to prosecute. That's one thing. The other thing is the other statute, I should say, is described on page 7. And it provides, on the bottom of page 7, it's CPL section 20.60 sub 1, provides that for purposes of this article, an oral or written statement made by a person in one jurisdiction to a person in another jurisdiction by means of telecommunication, mail, or any other method of communication is deemed to be made in each such jurisdiction. And I would also, I think, according to the county attorney, provide jurisdiction, because the communication having been received here would establish jurisdiction in New York State.
Again, so it's a technical matter, there is jurisdiction.
It's a technical matter, you know, and I defer to, obviously, colleagues from the district attorney's office. So, you know, we'll talk about this.
Okay, any more questions for Marty?
Well, we're not getting into the, I mean...
No, we're not. This is the first pass through to get, you know, as many speakers as we can on today to get a, to begin to discuss this topic. So next I'll ask Professor Wallman, you're next. And Perry, you're next after that, okay?
Okay.
Okay, thanks. And this is Professor Emily Wallman from Pace Law School, who has graciously agreed to come and share her thoughts on this topic.
Thanks so much for having me. Just to introduce myself, my name is Emily Waldman, and I teach, among other things, education law at Pace Law School. And in my work teaching education law, I've also written several articles about student speech, and in particular, on school districts' authority to restrict student speech. So similar, although a little bit different, because as we'll talk about, here we're talking about doing it through the criminal system as opposed to school districts suppressing or punishing students' speech. So first of all, I think a number of you have mentioned that this is an important issue, and I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's great that this is something that you're thinking about. The first thing I want to do just to sort of put it into context is to explain that so far, about 20 states have actually passed specific laws that address bullying, including, but usually not limited to, cyberbullying. Usually it's more of an anti-bullying statute that then includes, as one of the ways that bullying can be carried out, electronic communication, cyberbullying. So most of the states, and I know you've already started thinking about this issue, most of the states that do that, though, the way that they do it is by telling school districts that they need to adopt anti-bullying policies and then that they have to enforce them. So most states are not doing it through criminal system, which is what you're thinking about doing here in terms of actually making it a misdemeanor.
And just to note for the record, in your materials you have a summary of these statutes we've handed out. Mm-hmm. It's published by National Conference of State Legislatures. Okay, sorry.
Right. And so it's not to say it's unheard of, and in fact I think it's mentioned in the memo that, for example, Idaho recently adopted a statute which makes it an infraction. So using a criminal approach to engage in bullying. But for the most part, it's done sort of in the realm of the school districts. And that may be some of the things now that you're sort of struggling with is, I think maybe it's easier for people to accept the idea that the school would have the power to suppress or punish that speech than to actually turn it over to the criminal system. And I understand from talking to Marty that this body wouldn't have the power to tell school districts what to do. That the only, if this body were going to address it would have to do it through the criminal system. That's my understanding from talking to Marty. So when I was looking at this, I was wondering why you were taking that route, and now I understand why that's the route you're taking.
It's state legislature could do that.
The state legislature is considering doing that right now. But if Westchester were going to do something, it would have to be through the criminal system. And so that raises, I think, both legal and policy questions. On the policy level, the question is, you know, which body is better equipped to deal with these sorts of things? Which body do you want to deal with it? I mean, I can see some arguments for doing it through the criminal system. For example, you know, if someone feels, for example, that their school district isn't taking it seriously enough, it sort of creates a separate avenue. But at the same time, as I think a lot of you have recognized, it raises very serious issues in terms of the First Amendment when you're actually talking about criminalizing speech. And I think most commentators, when they've looked at the issue, have preferred the idea of leaving it to the school districts, with the idea that school districts are sort of closer to the situation, they have more flexibility, they have different ways of dealing with it. Often, at least in student speech cases, what happens before you even get to a punishment is the school first just tries to tell the person, you know, stop engaging in that speech. So it sort of gets cut short of ever reaching the level of a criminal proceeding. You know, even when the school does punish it, again, you're not talking about punishing it through the criminal system. You're talking about, you know, some sort of suspension or something like that. So it's different than actually turning it over to the criminal system, and I think that's just something to think about. The other legal issue is that, as the Supreme Court has elaborated on student speech rights, one of the basic ideas is that schools have more power and more flexibility to restrict student speech rights than does the government just vis-a-vis its citizens. And the whole idea is that schools sort of need a little bit more breathing room to make sure, for example, that at least at school, they maintain an orderly and safe learning environment. So once you're moving outside of the school and into the criminal system, then you're more limited in terms of what you can actually prohibit. And so that brings me to, I had a number of comments specifically on the legislation, but that brings me to my first one. And all my comments will really be on the First Amendment issue, not the criminal jurisdiction issue. That's really my research specialty. So I think that you're right to remove that last piece of the original legislation, which talked about a substantial interference, causing a substantial interference with the other person's ability to participate in or benefit from the services, activities, or privileges provided by school. And that language is coming from the Supreme Court body of cases that says that schools can restrict speech like that. But I think that you're absolutely right to take that out of the criminal statute. The other issue is, it's still very much an open question whether even schools can restrict that sort of speech when you're talking about electronic speech that is happening off campus. Even that's unresolved right now. The Supreme Court student speech cases all involve speech that was happening at schools, and it's well established that if it's speech at school, then the school can restrict it if it's interfering with the operation of the school. But there already is this open question that circuits are starting to weigh in, but hasn't gone up to the Supreme Court, about whether schools can restrict off-campus speech. So for all those reasons, I think it's right to take it out of this statute when you're talking about off-campus speech and then you're making it criminal.
Can I ask a question, if I may?
Sure.
Not pro or con, but I'm wondering the on-campus versus off-campus. When we're in the cyber world, we're sort of out of on-campus and off-campus, and we're not in Idaho, as somebody else had mentioned. We're borderless, in a sense.
Right.
So how does that weigh into this?
Well, that's, I think, exactly why all the lower courts are struggling so much with this whole question. It used to be, the Supreme Court had decided in these cases, these student speech cases involving speech at school. And before the internet, occasionally you had schools trying to restrict off-campus speech, and it was much easier in general for the courts to say, okay, well, that's off-campus speech. Those cases were about on-campus speech. There's sort of this territorial line, and what courts are really struggling now is exactly what you're saying, where it's the internet, so someone creates it at home, but then someone else goes onto the computer at school and loads it up or prints it out, and now it's at school, that it really is borderless, and that's something that courts are struggling with. A number of courts are starting to say that schools can restrict speech that originates off campus if then there's a nexus to a disruption at school. But even so, again, that's in the context of the school being able to, suppress or punish the speech, not it moving into the criminal system.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
First of all, does that include, when you talk about a disruption at school, does that include a school's assessment that this cyberbullying is inflicting mental distress on the target? For example, I noticed that the proposal, to go back to one of your points, it doesn't surprise me that the courts are now starting to see activity in the other area, because many of the states have enacted statutes that actually direct the school district that, you're to get involved here and you're to set policies, and by the way, it's on school grounds and off.
Mm-hmm. Some of them do, some of them are limited to school functions, but you're right.
But a number of them are. And the draft that's in front of us, I noticed, deals with, and I guess it's how broad you're going to define physical harm, but placing such other person in actual reasonable fear of physical harm. Mm-hmm. As though it's physical harm to me as a person, reasonable fear of property damage. But maybe what's going on here is inflicting such mental distress on me that you can't see the physical harm, but it has now permanently changed my mental state.
Right, and I think that's what that C was trying to deal with, that substantial detrimental.
Okay, but I think that is a very real outcome of cyberbullying.
I agree.
The on-school, off-school grounds distinction, I think you're going to find after a while that there may be no line that divides the two. The uh, the assessment of school officials that this is inflicting mental distress on students, that's something else. This really is an activity. This is like a 24/7 window of cyberbullying opportunity. That's what this is, and it's predominantly among, say, the when you look at your population, the students. So it's naturally it's logical that you get the schools involved. But I think that it raises some real questions as to whether or not it's possible to distinguish one from the other and set one aside. And it also, I think, kind of brings up the point, and I'm curious as to how this whole thing interfaces with what we know in society today isn't exactly, you have a blank check, you want to get involve yourself with libel or slander. You don't have a blank check to do what you want there. An individual does have recourse to come back at you. And so I don't think that the draft, which I know you're familiar with, I don't think that the draft in my mind deals with that, unless we have some very, very broad definitions of what physical harm, for example, is. If my state of mind is included in that definition, then I'm fine with that, but I don't know whether that's what the definition of physical harm is.
So the way the draft is set up, and I'll just mention, by the way, this last piece, which now seems like it's being taken out anyway, so I guess we should spend too much time talking about. But the thing about the substantial interference with such other person's ability, I mean, another sort of interesting aspect of that is, at least the way the Supreme Court has framed the test, it talks about disrupting the operations of the school as a whole. And so sometimes courts have had to think about, you know, when it's disrupting one student's education, is that enough? And usually they think that it is, especially because the Supreme Court has also said if you're invading another student's rights, that can be enough. But since we're probably taking out that piece, I think maybe what you're talking about is C, the thing about the substantial detrimental effect on another person's physical or emotional health.
Yeah, and I think that that's really the core of it.
Sorry,
because
a
lot of what we have seen goes beyond somebody being physically hurt
or
property damage. It goes to an infliction of mental distress that changes, is damaging them, their mental health.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And I think if you are going to do this, to not include something like C, which would say that if the cyberbullying is causing a substantial detrimental effect, you can think about exactly how you want to word it. But if you were just going to limit it to causing physical harm, you know, or threatening property damage, I'm not really sure how much it would be adding.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Just a quick question. I'm curious to know, is there a substantial amount of cases where present laws have been used to combat some of these cyberbullying offenses? Or do we need a cyberbullying statute to enable that? I mean, obviously, if the parent has a daughter who's being harassed, they're going to use whatever recourse they can. Is there a number of cases that have been?
As I understand it, I mean, that's something the DA's office, I think, can talk about better, because New York State does have anti-harassment laws, although, as I'll talk about, I think those are a little more limited than some of the things that this statute would arguably let someone go after. There are certainly harassment, you know, in different states.
And we're going to hear from the district attorney.
I'll let them talk about that. But I'll just make a few other comments that I have. So the first comment, as I said, was I think you're right to take out D, at least since you're going this criminal route, you're going beyond the school district too. The next one was, I know your focus is cyberbullying, and you may want to leave it back. I wasn't entirely sure why, when you're doing this, you would only be talking about cyberbullying as opposed to any harassment or bullying that has one of these effects. You know, it's limited in this way in terms of talking about bullying that's severe, persistent, or pervasive, and serves no legitimate purpose, and it would cause one of these effects. At that point, where it's sort of limited, I don't know why you would only be touching cyberbullying, but not touching, you know, in-person bullying that has that same effect. It seems to me, and I think somebody had said this, the cyber is really just another way of carrying that out, right? It's an electronic way, but why limit it to that? If you want to do it, you know, you can't. I don't think there's any legal reason that you can't, but I don't know Well, I agree, cyberbullying is a big problem. I'm not sure.
It might be something in the books already.
That's the thing that the DA's office can talk about. But I mean, the anti-harassment, New York's harassment laws, I understand it. It's not like that doesn't cover cyberbullying that now needed.
Right, exactly.
That does cover electronic. So I don't think that's the fight line. Okay. My other comment was, and this is also just something to think about, where you define it as, you know, any intentional written, verbal, or physical act or conduct directed at a specific other person. And for me, that raises a question of, often, especially with this situation of cyberbullying, the way you see that happening is, it's not necessarily someone sending an email to someone, but it's instead someone, let's say, creating a website devoted to bashing somebody, right? And then other people are piling on and putting in their comments. And I'm wondering whether this would capture that, because that is a lot of what happens, but maybe that's not sufficiently directed at that person. And so if you want to include situations where, you know, someone makes up a website to say all sorts of horrible things, you might want to see something at, like, directed at or concerning another person, something like that, just to sweep in that sort of situation. That's one way, and again, I'm interested in hearing the DA's office, that was one way that I was thinking that this might potentially go farther than existing anti-harassment looks. That's really, I think, focused on the kind of thing where you are kind of stalking the person or emailing them. Mm-hmm. So one way where this could potentially go broader would be if you talked about directed at or concerning a specific other person, and then it would sweep that in. So that's, I think, something to think about. And then my last comment was, there's one piece of language that I just thought you might want to tighten up when you talk about that a reasonable person, you define harassment or bullying, shall mean any intentional, written, verbal, physical act or conduct, et cetera, that a reasonable person under the circumstances would know could result in these various things, right? Like a person feeling threatened or a substantial detrimental effect. And I think that could language is a little bit loose, right? Because you can imagine a lot of people saying, well, I knew that that could happen, but I thought it was very unlikely to. And so you're potentially sweeping in a lot of things. If you say any time someone knows that it could happen, they're on the hook. You might want to say something more like, would happen, is likely to happen.
Reasonably likely to
reasonably
happen.
Likely, something like that. And in fact, if you look at a lot of the other statutes like that prohibit harassment, so usually it talks more about, you know, that is likely to cause a reasonable person to suffer emotional distress, or that would cause them to. I just think that could language is a little bit too loose. So if that last piece is taken out, which it sounds like it's going to be D, if those other changes are made, I was asked about the constitutionality. My sense is that on the whole, with those changes, this would be facially constitutional. Now, it would always depend on the particular case. I can imagine, you know, being applied to certain cases where the court would say, no, that goes too far. Now you're really running up against the First Amendment. But I think once you take out that last piece, once you change could to is likely to, I think it largely does run parallel to types of conduct that courts have said can be restrictive consistent with the First Amendment.
Well, given the hypothetical I gave before, mm-hmm. which I won't repeat because
right.
I don't like to repeat that stuff, but let's say somebody, the receiver is emotionally disturbed. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that would be unconstitutional if you applied it to that kind
well,
of?
Well, I think, I mean, and that actually brings me to one other thing. You have this reasonableness language. A reasonable person under the circumstances would know, because you may want to also require the substantial detrimental effect to itself be a reasonable response. I think if you're talking about a situation like that, the question would really be, is it severe, persistent, or pervasive? And did the person suffer severe enough emotional distress to qualify, and was that a reasonable response?
But
once you're getting into all of those things.
But the person who, the recipient, you know, you have the plaintiff with a very sensitive plaintiff versus someone else. Look, if you look at the journal news, we're talking about children and teenagers being affected by this. If you read the blog papers on the journal, blogs of the journal news, you see the members of this legislature are frequently the victims of cyberbullying, but we all let it roll off our skin.
Well, we don't read them.
Well,
I guess the question is, how severe is it, and would it be reasonable to suffer severe emotional, substantial
The prosecutor would have to prove that that plaintiff, if the plaintiff came in and said, look, I've had to see a psychiatrist, that, I've had all these emotional problems, but if the prosecutor would have to prove that it was reasonable for the person to have
not
that
only
reaction.
That the person experienced it, but that was an objectively reasonable response. And you may want to tweak that language even further to say, that it would cause a reasonable person to suffer that. In other
statutes, maybe a reasonable 15-year-old young woman would be reasonable for her to have emotional distress if someone sent that email.
Sure.
That's not unreasonable to me. Cause I've like three daughters, and they all went through teenage years. Mm-hmm. If they got an email like that, I could see they would be very emotionally upset, and it wouldn't be unreasonable. But is it protected by the First Amendment?
Well, another thing I think you could think about if you want to make sure that you exclude that situation is you could take out severe, persistent, or pervasive, and you can just, because that sort of implies that if it's persistent, it doesn't necessarily have to be severe, right? If it's severe, because I can imagine what someone is saying, well, it was persistent, even if it wasn't severe. So maybe what you want to say is severe and pervasive, something like that. And then at that point, if we're talking about language that really is severe, that really did cause this emotional distress, and that's considered to be a reasonable response, at that point, I think it likely would. Yes, muster under the First Amendment based on, what states generally do. I'm interested in hearing the DA's response, because at a certain point, I think that could even run into the New York State's harassment laws, depending on what the person's intent was in sending the email. So even those occasionally limit speech. So those are my comments, but I'm happy
any,
to
any questions for Professor Wallman before we move on to our next speaker? Thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate your taking the time to come here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, next on the list is our phone participant, Perry Aftab, I ran into you a number of years ago when you were doing law firm marketing stuff. I don't know if you're still doing that, but obviously you've gotten into cyberbullying now, so why don't you
Let me explain what I do, because there was reference to what Council Executive Sanova done on cyberbullying. That was me. So I run the world's largest and oldest internet safety charity, and we are called WiredSafety.org, and we run StopCyberbullying.org. We were members of the Harvard Internet Safety Technical Task Force. There were 20 individuals or entities assigned to look at these issues, especially in social networking. And we were part of the recently completed the National Telecommunications Information Agency Online Safety Technical Working Group, where we rendered a report on issues like this to Congress on June 4th. And I am also one of the five members of Facebook's Safety Advisory Board. So we generally advise the industry and the UN on cyber hate, Congress on transparency. Under the prior county executive, have been very, very active in Westchester on anything we could do to help. And underneath this all, I'm an internet privacy and security lawyer. So I'd love to clarify some things.
Okay, well, by the way, we're joined by our chair. Chairman Jenkins has come in, so. Go ahead. Sorry, Perry.
No problem. I think it's important that we understand cyberbullying and cyber harassment, the differences between them. And the differences are just language. When you're dealing with minors, the minor to minor activity, it's cyberbullying. If you are dealing with adults who are involved, it's cyber harassment. And it comes from kids who are, shoving each other into lockers and upside down into garbage cans in the schoolyard are often called bullies. If an adult did that, it's a fault and battery. So the same activities that take place with adults are harassment, and typically the same activities when they're done with minors, minor to minor, are called cyberbullying. It looks as though this law is intended to address adults and minors, and you may want to be aware of the previous speaker had indicated, the cyberbullying laws, and they're more than just 20. The legislators' website is not as up to date as it needs to be.
there are more of those. And cyberbullying laws in almost all cases are, as you indicated, relate to whether the school has authority or is given the mandate to do something about bullying during the school day, especially cyberbullying, that is between or among students, even if it is off premises, after hours, using technology not under control by the school and not of a school-sanctioned event or activity. So right now, all of the writing and a lot of the thinking has come at whether it come at the issue and whether or not a school has authority to deal with what one kid puts on a Facebook page from home on a Sunday night that is designed to hurt or target another student within the school. And they're trying to do that in some cases, or the early cases on this come out of the Vietnam War. Not a lot of new articulation. There's one case that came down from the Supreme Court called Bombs for Jesus that looks as though it's giving schools jurisdiction over what happened. After school hours, school had been shut down and the student had gone across the street when there was a VIP was coming in and the student had put up bombs, you know, Bombs for Jesus, and to offend everyone. And the school was actually able to punish him for what he had done when school was closed across the street from the school. So I think that there may be a trend at the Supreme Court level to allow a little bit more here, but something right now that is questionable. In the state of New York, we had two levels of harassment laws that dealt with electronic harassment as well. One was declared unconstitutional several years ago, and now from what I was told, although I'm admitted in New York, I haven't parsed the exact language of this recently enough for it, it's just a recollection, that the statewide harassment laws requires serious threat of bodily harm or against property to apply. So I think that if we're going to be relevant on what we're doing on a law here, and I think that there's a benefit to do it. I think Westchester has led before. He led on the ESRB and game ratings and how they have to be in all of the stores, and I assisted with that. And you also led at the issue of requiring that all commercial enterprises in Westchester use a security code for an open Wi-Fi. So this, you know, these are relevant. But so I think there's relevance here. What we need to do is make sure we're not mirroring the cyber harassment law at the state level, because then why bother? But it's important that we add value. Added value comes in two different areas. One is the actual prosecution, and two, the ability of the prosecutor's office to subpoena information from the service providers that they may need to find out who it is, even if they may not ultimately prosecute. Right now, at the Facebook, you know, Microsoft, AOL, your Opt Online, whatever it is we're doing this, their privacy policies provide that they will not generally turn over information to anyone without valid legal process, court order, subpoena, warrants, etc. And that means that when someone comes at you, whether they're saying they're Jimmy Smith or they actually are Jimmy Smith, you may not know how that ties to an actual person. And for that to happen, the website fall collects what's called an IP address, an Internet Protocol address. And there are two different kinds. One is static, and the other is dynamic. Static is if you are the Westchester County Executives or the legislators. You have servers that have IP addresses that you own, and anyone who uses your internet connection through there will track back to one of your IP addresses. And we always know that that goes back to the Westchester governmental server. The others are the ones that most of us as individuals have. You get, you know, your Opt Online or Cable, whoever it is your provider. They lend you one of their millions of IP addresses for every time you log on to the server, so you may be on for a month before you reset your router or restart things, but they give you an IP address at that time that they lend you. Law enforcement serves a subpoena on them and says, we need information about who is using this IP address at 2:35 Eastern Standard Time on July 2nd. And that information is brought out. And sometimes it is one of their subscribers, and the answer will be Jimmy Smith's parents, and this is where they live. And sometimes it's not that direct. It may be that was used by somebody who logged in with a Hotmail address, etc. But you need law enforcement to be able to get involved to be able to find out who's behind it, to know if it's a credible threat or it's just a 10-year-old who was bored that day. And so if you put in a law, even if you never actually prosecute under it, but if we have a law in place that's upheld, that gives the Westchester DA's office, which happens to be one of the best law enforcement DA and prosecutor's office in the United States. If you give them now the legal authority to reach out and issue a subpoena and say to Facebook, who was using this at that time, that can be incredibly valuable, because then sometimes, once you really know who it is, and you know if it's a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old, you may elect the jail is not the right source, but being able to turn around and say to their parents, we know it was your kid who did this, can be incredibly valuable. And to say to the victim, this is Al-Qaeda who's targeting you with the 10-year-old. So that's an important issue we need to think about. You also need to recognize that during that event that I did with County Executive Spano, we've done many of them, and that was for both Smith State University and separate, and we asked 200 middle school students from Westchester if they had ever been cyberbullied. And we didn't ask them that way, because everyone defines cyberbullying differently. It's like love. So we said, has anyone ever stolen your password and taken over your account and locked you out of it? Has anyone ever posted false rumors about you online or told the secret intentionally to embarrass or hurt you? Anyone taken your head and put it on somebody else's naked body? Anyone ever picked up your cell phone when you weren't looking and sent nasty things to your friends so that it came out of your text messaging account and they thought you did it? Has any, those having set up an account and had you spammed by porn? Has anyone ever set up an account pretending to be you to get you into trouble with whatever? Anyone have sent you 3,000 text messages saying you're fat over and over again? And 97% of the students, of the 200 students in that room, said it had happened to them at least once. Now, my star teen angel group in the world, they are teen internet safety experts. Maze was there at the last meeting that apparently had ended early. But my star teen angel chapter in the world is from New Rochelle. It's from the Earthline School. And they have done extensive research on a peer-to-peer basis that's been featured by the UN and others and by major publications and used on research and training programs. And they found on a smaller survey done of boys in Catholic high schools in Westchester that 70% of the 1,200 students polled indicated that they had cyberbullied somebody else at least once in the last year. This happens, and it happens a lot. And the difference between you're fat and ugly and everybody hates you one time, which is clearly protected speech, rude, but protected, you're fat sent to you 5,000 times by text that month, which may involve huge text cell phone bills to your parents if you're not on an unlimited plan, or the kind of complaint or comment to you that might not be, that you might be able to get away with prostitution, but it's the persistent and repetitive nature of something that's a lesser issue, is something we have to address. I'm going to kill you, someone's going to kill you, I'm going to rape you, I'm going to hack your computer, happens far less. And that's called a direct attack. Direct attack is one, if we're talking about youth or anybody, one person to another person, it's a threat of severe bodily harm, death, you're going to hurt their dog, you're going to kill somebody who's close to them. And this is covered under existing law in New York, but that's a direct threat. Indirect is you try to provoke action by others. You go to a white supremacist website and the black student that you're targeting, you either pretend to be that black student, or you will go to that site and repeat something that he or she didn't say, so that hate group will now target that student with name, address, and telephone number. It's been done where they've done it to pedophile group where they posted information about nine-year-olds because they wanted to get back at parents. They have done it with Jewish students at neo-Nazi sites. That posting information that's designed to get others to take action against your victim is something you really should be dealing with. It exists already under sexual exploitation. So federally, if someone posts something designed to get someone else to sexually exploit someone under the age of 16, federally, it's a felony. And last is, it's important that if people are going to do this, that we deal with the spoof account. Someone who goes in and either takes over your account because they guessed your password or they used to date to renew it, or someone who creates an account pretending to be you. And that is the vast majority of the direct intentional cyberbullying that occurs, as well as the reputational attacks. In fact, she's ugly, everybody hates her, she's got venereal disease, etc. And I think if you can find ways of dealing with the account takeovers, which I think is legitimate and clearly okay, so accessing someone's account without their permission or setting up an account, posing as them with the intention that people will believe that you are that person, that's very valuable and doesn't exist under federal or state law as it exists right now. And I think that it's important that we're going to deal with this now. And direct, now there may be a way, and I think we just need to spend a little more time on the constitutional issue, but comments, posts, communications that are intended to destroy the reputation of severely and reasonably and adversely affect the reputation of someone in the same way that we have defamation per se. Someone is sexual diseases, somebody molesting children, somebody deceased, those kinds of things. The way we can do that, I think, can be very helpful.
Okay. Thanks,
Pat. I'm happy to help in any way we can.
Good. Thanks a lot. You've kind of enlarged our horizons here and raised some issues that the issue of someone spoofing an account. Some of us have already seen one of my legislative aide. I got an email from her last month saying, I'm in London and we were just robbed and we have no money and we can't get back. And it turned out that I talked to her that morning and I knew she wasn't in London. But many people called her and said, are you okay? And that happened to someone else I've heard of, too. So thanks a lot.
That actually happened to Tina Meyer, Megan Meyer's mom, the girl who committed suicide after that mother down the street did this. And because everyone knew Tina and knew she didn't have any money, she got a lot, whoever it is who did this. But that, I think, is valuable. I think that's very valuable. And the DA's office knows this stuff cold. You've got the best guys in the world there in Westchester. And so anything I can do to help at any time, please let us know.
Thank you, Perry. Thanks.
Okay,
so we'll move to our next speakers. Maybe we'll invite you both up since you represent the school community. Lisa Davis, Executive Director of the Westchester Putnam School Board, and Isabel Burke from who coordinates school safety for Southern Westchester BOCES. So have a seat, ladies, and fill us in on what you're doing and what you'd like to see done, if anything, and your reaction to what you've heard. Red.
Thank you for alerting us that this discussion was going on. We really probably have less that we planned to talk about, and we really came to listen. And
okay.
There was some conversation earlier about taking out the part that really talks to the schools, that obviously was of great concern to us because, as was said previously, the state has jurisdiction over schools and has to be done through education law, and the county doesn't. So that was really important. I did get some feedback from someone who is a school district attorney to try to get some sense about what some of their initial reactions were to this, letting them know that it was very preliminary and it was really just the early stages of the dialogue. So some of this actually changes from the discussion that has already happened here today, but there was a concern that it really went too far in defining what was sanctionable conduct, and I think that was talked about previously. And that one of the things that's interesting, if you look at a lot of the code of conducts and a lot of the things that the schools do, they're really about training, about awareness, about how to create opportunities, really to turn them into learning opportunities, if you will. And this law is very punitive. It's all about the criminal end, which is very different from most anything that you'll see in education law related to something like that. So one of the things that was expressed is if there is going to be anything that has to do with schools, there's really, if schools were mentioned, again, that D part might be out. But then there was nothing that really talked about how, what the interaction would be. How would, let's say something did happen and the DEA's office is pursuing something, there was nothing to talk about how they would then bring the schools in or let them be aware of what they had found. And that communication piece really seems to be missing, which is really important. As was mentioned earlier, it's a very big, currently kind of gray and maybe turning a little more black and white issue. For schools, because so much of this does happen not on the school computer, but it happens on another computer. It happens on, you know, AOL or Gmail or Facebook, whatever it might be, not using the school's computer, but yet it affects the kids when they arrive in school and certainly affects one child's ability to concentrate and learn and everything. I won't repeat everything that was said. So I think that it really brings into play if the DA's office or some of the police are aware of something, how do they then make the school aware of it so that the school can be a partner with that? The sharing of information would really be an important piece. And I think the only other thing is that I'd add is that he also expressed, which was again said earlier, there's some discussion at the state level about some legislation, and that since it does seem to be active, if one can use the word active, with our state legislature. But that there is something that's certainly percolating up there that maybe to wait and see what does come out of the state, since it seems like something that they are looking to take some action. There was the Dignity for All Act, you know, which is a little bit different, but yet really touches on a lot of the same issues. So that was really the last piece that was brought up, and I think it's very interesting. It's obviously a very big and very important issue, and the world is changing.
Excellent. Go ahead, Isabel.
Yeah, I'd like to comment. School safety is dramatically different today than it was when I went to school and probably when everyone here went to school. And parents get understandably jumpy and upset and concerned. And what would be ideal, if you're going to put in place anything, would be a piece that helps to educate people about what is appropriate, what's inappropriate. And so when we see an act that has the penalties and the hotline, but nothing in it about helping people in the county to understand what is acceptable, what's unacceptable, then it may not be enough to help people to make their choices accordingly, particularly if you're talking about a 16, 17, or 18-year-old who, in the eyes of the law, may not be a minor, but, of course, who may not yet be ready to have the judgment. So it might be advisable to build in something that gives better guidelines or allows people to be educated and become aware.
Any questions? Thank you. It was helpful to get your reaction.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know I understand there's three or four or five sponsors for this, because I'm trying to put all this together. Can I ask any of the sponsors, you know, why they went the criminal route? You know, how do we get that?
Can we save that?
Okay, well, that's
because I don't want to hold up because we have another set of speakers.
Okay.
Then we'll have that.
Because we have the DA's office here, but I just.
Then we'll have the discussion among ourselves.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure. That's fine.
Do you have anything else? Any other questions for the.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, as well. Just a quick question. When part of, I guess, philosophically in a little bit with legislative gossip, which is asking about, there is a bunch of things floating around for lack of a better term, they're trying to deal with this particular issue. But most of the ones, at least, that we've read so far, or the ones we saw out there so far, were targeted at schools, and they were trying to have schools do additional items without funding them, right? You know, from a mandate perspective. So one of the things that, you know, in considering this piece of legislation was trying to do tools that we have in existence already. So we have, as the unsolicited advice from Perry saying that we have a fantastic DA's office, well, we have a bunch of internet things already in place. to do that. So we'll hear some more about that later. But for you from the school's perspective, I mean, what roadblocks are you all seeing from your positions in the schools and dealing in the schools that can or that have been preventing, you know, the level of education thing from happening? I mean, we don't want to wait until another sad scenario comes up before we're trying to take action, and that's part of the reason. So if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'll tell you that since the Project Save Act of 2000, we have had many school districts work on their codes of conduct. And if you read them carefully, and I've read hundreds of them so far, you can feel the intent of the committee and then the board within these codes of conduct. There are some that are clearly punitive. There are some that are clearly educational, and then there are a lot that have both.
This is a state law you're referring to?
State law that requires every school district.
And you've reviewed the actions taken by hundreds of school districts within New York State.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And possibly thousands if you look at the ones I've read over the country. I have a book out on school policy, but this is what I do a lot.
Well, that would be an interesting thing to take further look at, because you've been looking at, with respect to the state, you've been looking at then actions taken by somewhere around 700 school districts. I'd be curious to know, even here in this county, I think there's closer to 700 school districts in New York.
But I didn't look at them all.
No, but you're working within that group.
But maybe we can get some of those codes of conduct.
But even we may even want to see what school districts in Westchester have actually done. Because I think that's something that, I don't know whether there's that much information that's been made available to the board as to what schools who seem to, in many cases, you hit it right on the head. You look at Ohio, you look at Mississippi, you look at Massachusetts, they have responsibility not only to develop codes and boards of education to adopt codes, but also to disseminate to parents, to students, to school employees, and to provide them with regular updates on changes. And I don't think we've really
information. Can we get some examples maybe of codes?
I will tell you that almost every school district has them on their website, particularly the code of conduct.
We'll check. Thanks, we can do that.
And in fact, if you go onto our website, and I'll give you the site, we have links to every school district, so it'll make it a lot easier for you to find them.
Good.
But it's the code of conduct, because it does involve, it says right in there the parents' responsibility, the students' responsibility, the teachers, the schools. Because it really affects everybody. If they don't have all their
they
other policies,
most of their time worrying they about do have that. How the internet is used properly and legally more than cyberbullying. That's where schools really concentrate on that students don't copy and paste.
Regarding plagiarism. Mm.
Those are the things that they really concentrate on more than the cyberbullying, I would say.
Yeah, but that's a different policy.
I know that, but I'm saying that.
Right, school use of technology.
Those policies you'll find everywhere, but the cyberbullying you might not find.
However, I do want to say, having worked with many school districts, they have plenty to do. And it's difficult when you talk about behavior that many times does not start in a school and many times doesn't end in a school, but does involve a school. I'm not sure that it would be appropriate or safe to ask a school to be the arbiter of something like that.
Which is part of the reason. So that kind of answers the part of the question of why. We're beyond the school district, but we understand we're all in the same community, right? And it's all interconnected. So. Again, just hearing the things from the school district's perspective is just...
Yeah, and I would add also that I think on a lot of these, when it becomes apparent that it's, and to use the terms that are in there, pervasive or persistent or severe, the police are almost always called in. I think if there's something that's reported and there really is a sense, there's a lot of partnering, at least in most districts. With the police to really get them involved if it appears that there's something that's outside the school and has potentially some criminal.
Mr. Chairman, from the experiences that many of us have in our communities, especially in these difficult economic times, where we saw a scenario where they would have many more DARE officers and that kind of thing, and you saw funding either dry up for those particular things, and now the police aren't in the schools, and youth officers and community affairs type officers are being eliminated out of budgets for economic reasons. And now what ends up happening is the school district either has
taking, having to take those on, and they're focusing on reading, writing, arithmetic, and you know, it just doesn't happen. And as we've seen,
well, let's hear from the DA's office about what's
also a training issue of the technology. The kids are much more advanced on the technology than many of the school personnel, so they get away with more than.
I do think the reality of the funding is a really important piece. If you look at, for example, the Dignity for All, it has funding impact, it says minimal. But it's all about training and writing things, and we all know that
takes
that's
time.
Not minimal.
Time is money. Yes, one more question first.
Could you just spend maybe a minute, what would be a very quick fact pattern as to how you would get drawn into interfacing with police on a complaint by a mother and father about something that they have seen is just going on too much and it's affecting my son or daughter in this way? What typically might happen?
A good example, unfortunately, would be pictures taken inside a locker room.
Okay.
As a former phys ed teacher, I can tell you that the one thing you don't want in a locker room is cameras, and now they come in because of the cell phones, which are usually banned in 98% of all schools, but they show up. And those pictures then go all kinds of places and end up in all kinds of hands.
Child notifies the parent, this is what happened, the parents go crazy, they contact the police. What then happens? How do you,
for school?
That's a possibility, but I'm just kind of playing with the fact that a lot of this is directed toward Board of Education, take steps, adopt the policy. If that is not part of this, now we're talking about just the law enforcement in the community and the actions that they take and the actions that you take. How are you drawn into it if something occurs in Yonkers and Yonkers police are advised and they show up and they look at it, do they come to you? Do they present?
Very rarely. If it was outside.
Well, how do they dispose of it then?
I would say that I think in a lot of these cases, the parents do call the school because they want the principal to get involved because they do feel that it's affecting how their child is
socially. This,
the parents have to be the impetus to go to the police.
Yeah.
So this discussion about, you know, your point about the schools may not be the best one. Maybe it could very well be that we're seeing with so many of the states, they go to the schools. Maybe in the end, they may not be the best one, but they may be the only one because they have that connection. If it's nothing more than, it's not disrupting of school activity, it's not affecting
more leeway.
It's the relationship of you're part of the district because you're a student.
That is true, but we do have to also acknowledge that school administrators have no training in gathering evidence, preserving evidence, and for them, you'd be asking them to take on a quasi-legal role, which not only may not be appropriate, but could be somewhat disruptive.
Oh, yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Yes, I can see that being an issue.
But before you get to the point of collecting evidence and doing all those other things, there is what typically I believe school boards have to contend with. The issue's been raised. What do we do as a board with respect to policy setting?
And that's where the code of conduct comes in, because, and I tend to think that a lot of them do say electronic in there.
Oh, they do. Oh, yes. It's very often lumped in with a whole bunch of
things. They prohibit electronic devices, but they don't really.
Or that of it being a means of what would happen, and, you know, encouraging you to look through. The only other thing I bring up is, you know, it's always interesting because, and it goes to some of the, why this is so great and so challenging, is you could have an incident that comes up and it's brought to the attention of the school administration because the child is feeling really harassed, the parents might call. Then another set of parents are brought in who don't really think that it is the school's purview or don't really think it's such a big deal. And a lot of it really does come down to parent education. And it's very hard as a parent now to be able to monitor what your child is doing because all of these devices are so personal. You know, it's not like when someone used to call your house and you know the answering machine who they were hanging around with because you'd hear the messages.
And you had the language with it.
So it does raise that whole, everyone has a slightly different threshold, and I think that's why this is such a tricky and challenging arena. It's new and it's different people react to it differently.
I think that's a good segue into our last set of speakers.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Because now we're going to hear from the district attorney's office, and we have Assistant District Attorney Mary Kornman and Assistant District Attorney Mike DeLore.
DeLore.
DeLore, sorry.
No, DeLore.
DeLore, the right way to pronounce it, DeLore. And, you know, questions have been raised about what laws are on the books that are enforced and what the role of law enforcement is. So here's law enforcement. And we thank you for waiting so long. One advantage of your waiting is you heard all the positive comments about the DA's office. So that's
exactly. Unsolicited.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Mike is the Bureau Chief of the High Technology Crime Bureau, and I'm the Bureau Chief of the Strategic Planning and Crime Prevention Bureau. So we have each have a slice of this. Just to start out, I think we would want to make sure we make it clear, we're only addressing a criminal, not a civil context.
Right.
And a lot of things that were raised here today belong in a civil context. Whatever their merits, they're not DA's material.
But the proposed law is a criminal.
Correct. And that's a legislative determination, which obviously we leave to the Board of Legislators. We really come to describe what we are doing now on these issues from the point of view of cases and from the point of view of prevention. And we're doing it with in settings that involve children who are younger than the age that we would prosecute if they're in an ordinary criminal situation. We're working at a broader issue.
I mean, under 16.
And just to address some of the comments about schools, there are very specific limitations on what information in a criminal investigation can be shared. So that while I could see where you would want, would be useful in some ways, there are very specific limitations on that. So that's really not something on which there's a great deal of flexibility. And finally, as everybody knows, criminal cases are very fact-specific. And there is an element of prosecutorial discretion. And none of that is something that can be speculated about or generalized about, but comes into every prosecutorial decision. And that's an important factor, particularly when we're talking about certain age groups and so forth. But obviously, this legislation is not age limited, but that's an issue that affects every case. Briefly go through. The crime prevention work that the DA's office does is part of a broad community outreach. It has to do with addressing, among other people, parents and students on issues that include internet safety, but also gang and gun violence and dating violence and drinking and drug abuse. And the goal is to try to advise people against unwise behavior, but also to engage them positively. So at the same time, we send assistant DAs into classrooms to talk about legal issues, and we have students coming for court tours. And so the idea is to try to create a climate of positive interaction with a goal toward crime prevention. To give you a sense of this, in 2009, we had prosecutors, the DA herself and prosecutors from the office, did over 350 presentations or workshops for students or parents. 61 of them were on internet safety, and 50 of those were specifically bullying prevention. This year, so far, focusing on electronic media, we've done 47 internet safety presentations, 10 for parents, 37 for students, and that'll pick up again, obviously, in September. And these are tailored for specific audiences, parents, high school students, middle school students, and obviously the content varies somewhat. As I say, they include audiences that are too young to be considered for prosecution by our office, but are not too young to hear a prevention message. Bullying prevention is geared primarily to middle school students. And it involves, as many of you have mentioned, the full range of bullying activities, including that which is carried on by electronic media. All of the presentations include a discussion of privacy, the importance of privacy in online communications, the dangers of revealing personal information, which include obviously dangers from internet predators, the need for caution in posting information or photos, particularly on social websites which have varying degrees of security, having to do with internet predators, but also having to do with soft consequences, college applications and employment applications when you've, you know, had ridiculous pictures of yourself as a teenager with a bottle of rum in your hand. This does not help you as an older teen. But there's a specific discussion of cyberbullying in all these presentations, and it talks about the use of words, the use of electronically transmitted words, photos, messages, and so forth.
We make specific reference to Penal Law Section 240.30, aggravated harassment in the second degree.
If we provide you a copy.
And we mention that violators can be prosecuted. And the goal is to prevent dangerous or abusive behavior and to start a conversation, going back to the school context, to start a conversation among students, among parents, among school personnel, so that there is a consistent message of avoiding this behavior, but also a context or a culture of responding decisively when these events arise. And that's what we want to contribute to. Our role is fairly limited as prosecutors. The issue is broader than that. We can only intervene in a particular set of facts. Mike is going to pick up with a discussion of some of the legal issues that these...
We have a whole host of different types of cases that involve what is being characterized as cyberbullying. We do not characterize it that way because that's not the law. We look at it quite simply as what we can apply, and typically that would involve some type of harassment. And we also look at it in different ways. There are other types of threats that come through that it would be more appropriate. There's some state legislation about threats where you are going to claim that you're going to destroy a building. Other threats can be handled as far as email forgeries, and I'll get into some of the more specifics. The issues with trying to handle cases involving especially the middle school children is quite simple. We will conduct that investigation with the assumption that it is an adult involved until we know better, because we are not going to take the chance that it would really be an adult. So we look at it from the viewpoint, if we get somebody who says, I'm going to kill you, and that's sent through an email, we look at that as a flat-out harassment, and we will pursue it as if it was an adult, even though logically it may be a child. Once we find out that it is a child and that it's somebody that we could not prosecute, then that matter is referred over to the county attorney's office for prosecution. We do a lot of work with Peter Jackson in particular in sending him cases involving different types of cases. Right now, we've been sending over a lot of issues involving child pornography. And that is something else that would need to be addressed, because a lot of what is taking place now, we see, involves students, and it's already been discussed about having access to cell phones and the ability that the cell phones have not only to record video, take pictures, but also to transmit them and to basically send them out very quickly to a number of individuals. And that has been a huge concern to us, because depending on the age of the child, that could actually be considered child pornography. And you would then have an issue of this person, whoever is sending it, would then be guilty of promoting an obscene sexual performance, which is a D felony. And we obviously take those exceptionally seriously. And this puts, and if this has been mentioned about what do you do with 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, because quite frequently that is what's going on. They are the ones sending it. And in New York, they can be given special treatment for youthful offender, so that they could be arrested, they could be held to the charge, and ultimately, when they reach 18, assuming they've not done anything else, they've stayed out of trouble, well, then that would be erased from their record. So that is partly how that issue can be addressed. But these things are happening on a regular basis. It's been happening for a number of years, and part of what we're doing, as Mary said, we are trying to get to the students at a young age so that they know the ramifications, and we're not trying to sugarcoat it, especially when we're talking to the high school students. We're pretty blunt about what can happen to them. Now, one of the other things that was discussed was about slander and what you could do with somebody who's posting information about you that's very derogatory. It really depends. A lot of that is going to be civil, and obviously we're not going to get into that. However, it could be, and we know this from talking to different schools and seeing what has happened. There have been times where students have thought that it would be funny to put up a web page. They've usually gone to MySpace and Facebook and make it appear that they are this other person. Sometimes it's a teacher, sometimes it's another student. We have had cases where they actually went and put up a picture of the school resource officer, and they pretended to be him. In that case, ultimately, it was the decision of the individual involved not to go forward with it. But what we found was that this person claimed to be the police officer, put up his picture, which they had taken from the department's website, and then basically created a background of marijuana leaves. They made reference to him as being a pedophile, that he liked to go out drinking with them, that he provided them with marijuana. I mean, obviously, things that would be very derogatory for a law enforcement agent. The interesting thing was the way we found this person. Perry Aftab made mention about IP addresses and things like that. Well, that's one way of trying to track somebody. The other way was the practical and very simple way. We went to the website. We saw who else had posted the information. Some of them were kind enough to put up their real pictures. they were then tracked down by the yearbook, and then a visit was made to their parents. Now, you know, in years gone by, you would have thought there was honor among thieves, but that no longer exists. They quite quickly gave up the person right away. And this is a message that we do bring to the students, because it is important to let them know that, all right, this may on the surface have been a prank, and we understand that. However, it started to go beyond the prank when you started saying these things about a law enforcement agent or your teacher. And we know from the teachers that they're very offended by it. I don't know if anybody has ever done anything civilly with it. We've had some complaints criminally, but we have ultimately not gone forward with it because the teacher did not want
to. But you could have prosecuted, that could be prosecuted under what statute?
The theory is that it's a forgery. We were the first county in the whole country to ever prosecute somebody for email forgery. And because the website can't be considered a written document, and you are now changing that, and you're pretending to be the ostensible maker, and you are not, and you are in some way affecting a right of theirs, then our theory has been that we can charge that as a forgery. And we have contemplated doing that, but so far have not actually done that in this type of scenario. But it is something that's out there.
Can I just ask to that point? And also this goes to what the speaker on the phone said, the issue of account takeovers being a major part of this puzzle. And you're saying that you have the tools now on that aspect to prosecute as forgery.
There are several items that Ms. Aftab said to you that I think need clarification, because I think she misspoke in what she said. First off, the issue that she addressed about subpoenas, that's covered by the grand jury, by the state, and that's reserved to them. And it's only the grand jury that issues a subpoena. So that needs to be very carefully handled. This area is covered federally. It's covered by the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. So there are some laws in place already about that. On our state level, some of the things she mentioned that we cannot do is actually not true. We can do. There are computer trespass, computer tampering laws that are in place. And as I've just spoken about, we have handled an email case involving a forgery. So there are several laws already in place that we can do. And that would continue in with some of the school bomb threat cases. We've handled a number of these over the past 10 years, especially since Columbine. We've been quite fortunate in all of the ones that have come to us. We have been able to find out who the perpetrator was. And the reason that we've been able to do it is that we really know what we're doing. We've done this for a long time. We've been doing this for almost 13 years. And we have great relationship with a lot of the internet service providers. So when we make a call to AOL, I literally know all the people down there, because many of them were former prosecutors that I've worked with over the years. And when I call and I say something about, this is a bomb threat, this is urgent, they know that it is, and they get to it right away. The most recent one that we've had is from a few years ago, involved Scarsdale High School, and we were able to get to the door, and we're knocking on the defendant's door within an hour after having received the complaint. Ultimately, it was found out that it was a 14-year-old who decided he wanted early Christmas vacation. So, but you know, that's not unusual for us to have to run into these types of cases. Now, one of the other cases that was mentioned was the case that is really from Missouri, although it was handled by the district court in Southern California. In that case, a mother did pretend to be a boy and was contacting the next-door neighbor, who was Megan Meyer. The mom was Lisa True. The case went to trial down there and ultimately was all dismissed. And you know, the dismissal was based on some of the federal statutes that were in place, but you know, that's just a case that is out there right now.
Was she originally convicted and then was reversed on appeal? I can't remember.
No, it was the same judge Lou that had it. Yes.
John,
yes.
Just a question. Maybe Mike or Mary could help clarify this. When the speaker on the telephone was talking about start to work on a draft that would actually bring something to the table in terms of improvements to the current situation, be very careful or don't end up with something that really overlaps what is in state statute now. All right. I was struck by, well, maybe a lot of this she viewed as overlapping state law, and there was a brief discussion about some of the additional tools that might be provided if we were to enhance this in some way, the ways that were suggested. Did you in listening to that conversation, did you immediately focus on anything where we are in fact duplicating what is not in discussion now in Albany, because I think that was part of the conversation as well. But what is actually in any section of the law that deals with this kind of thing?
Well, if any of this was to come to us as far as school bullying and say it was somebody for an appropriate age that we could handle that case, what we have done is we've looked at it as a harassment, as an aggravated harassment.
Yeah, and you mentioned that 5 minutes ago, yeah. I just
the Peter point you made is you can already get that information.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point because it has to be a crime with the person of appropriate age, and that's why I said in the beginning that we really, well, especially when we have something that really may involve a minor, we're going to look at it as if it's an adult, at least initially, so we absolutely know that's for sure.
Just to be clear,
because otherwise there would be no way of getting a subpoena.
Committee members, anybody under 16 would go to family court, would be prosecuted in family court.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, because she was drawing a distinction. You're right, John, right on that point. And
adults and children.
And yeah, exactly. And in kind of, I don't want to say dismissing, but in choosing not to really discuss a lot of what is in the draft, put on the table two new areas that might be considered as enhancements. And I'm thinking, well, have we inadvertently put something in front of us that really is just covering the same territory as the, what is actually already in statute?
Some items that were not in this proposed law, but I think Mike addressed them and said they already have the tools.
Well, yeah, and he mentioned the newer,
the takeover,
the other one about the
let's just turn. If we could just turn.
Issues of completion.
Just to follow on, and you maybe you answered it, just because Mike, I said this earlier. And both of you referred to sort of age appropriate, you obviously, you know, prosecutorial discretion. This law, on the surface of it, says no person, which is anybody, shall engage in this, and it's, you know, it's a misdemeanor. So if we were to pass this as is, what I heard you saying, if the perpetrator turned out to be 13, 14, even though this law on the first says that is a misdemeanor, you would use your discretion and not. Or either goes to family court, or you
wouldn't. It's actually no discretion on our part.
It has to go to family court.
It's mandatory.
So it's mandatory. Goes to family, but family court to be dealt with as a misdemeanor. I mean, it's still dealt with as a misdemeanor, or is it? I'm not clear.
The county attorney's office that handles it.
I see. So I mean, so there's law in front of us. I mean, anybody under 18 is my
16.
So it only covers, this law covers a 10-year-old, but only 16 and 17-year-olds would be potentially prosecuted by your office. And even there, you have discretion. I heard you talking. I mean, I'm just, based on the words here, I'm just trying to follow who there's a 12-year-old.
It's a very good point.
Yes, I'm just trying to follow from the drafting what this says, what the intent of what the law is. So I come back. I have a lot of questions about the intent of the sponsors were in this law. I'm just trying to read it because I
issue
hear that.
The ages, yeah. If they're under 19, they are eligible for youthful offender, which means that at the end, if they.
Right, but it could be a second. Right, but on the face of this, if it's a 14-year-old, you're saying he just goes to family court automatically?
Yes.
Okay, so this probably should have started. I'm just trying to. Just trying to understand.
The question I want to ask is similar. If you look at the three prohibitions currently in there, one is placing such another person in actual or reasonable fear of physical harm to himself or herself or to a third person. Is that redundant with the harassment statute, basically?
We can't get into giving you opinion about that. We can tell you about some of the cases that we've handled.
All right. Let me get to the concern I have is number C. A substantial detriment is the preparatory language. A substantial detrimental effect on such other person's physical or emotional health. Do you prosecute that under any other statute? That type of result where someone engages in intentional written, verbal, or physical act or conduct directed at another person, which is severe, persistent, or pervasive, blah, 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 and such person would know that it's a substantial detrimental effect on such other person's physical or emotional health.
Say is that if we're going to prosecute something, it would be using the guidelines that are within the aggravated harassment statute, and you've seen that language.
Right. But you mentioned some other interesting steps. Well, there's the forgery one, there's the child pornography one, so there's other statutes as well.
And that's, especially with the child pornography, we want to let the students know that this is something that they are facing. They may not realize it. And I don't know that it would have to really depend on what was going on.
Right.
In one of the cases we had, it was completely accidental. A 14-year-old, for whatever reason, decided to do a video of herself starting at the top where she was naked, going all the way down, and then progressed to her masturbating. And she left this on her phone. And then she lost the phone at school. And so
somebody found it,
and it was then sent out to everybody that was on her list, and mostly, you know, people in her school. Technically, that's promoting an obscene sexual performance by a child. And whoever was doing that, especially if they were of sufficient age, could have been prosecuted.
A felon.
A felon.
Thanks. Getting back to Legislator Nona's line of questioning, if I know you're not going to comment on specifics in this law. Let me flop the question around and say, are there tools that you don't have that you wish you had to make your job more productive in the prosecution of these types of crimes?
Very good question.
At any level, state law, federal law, county law, you know, we're speaking academically here.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't speak that way.
Well,
we have the laws that we have to enforce.
All right, but on the other hand, though, you also see the loopholes
in those laws.
So good.
You see loopholes in those laws. What tools would you need or would you want to make your job easier?
Anything that would be said about that would be going through the. New York State District Attorney's Association, I couldn't comment on that.
Yeah, I know. Okay. I think that was close to the end of the discussion.
That was a good lawyer.
Chairman.
That was good.
That's a lousy answer, quite frankly.
I'm going to try a different way.
If you go to the DA's Association, then you would know.
The question? Mr. Chairman, thank you, and we thank you for your comments in this, because it's helpful. Because basically, the question that I think that we want to pose a different way is,